This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Eagles fans are gearing up for the team's rematch with the Dallas Cowboys this Sunday after a humiliating loss in October. The football team has been on a winning streak under backup quarterback Nick Foles' strong performance on the field. Can they make it to the playoffs, to the Super Bowl? This year, all of Philadelphia's professional teams have new coaches. Chip Kelly for the Eagles, Brett Brown for the 76ers, Craig Berube for the Flyers, and Ryan Sandberg for the Phillies. And while the Eagles have been enjoying success recently, the other teams have struggled this year. Well, today in Radio Times, we look back on some of the Philadelphia sports stories of the year and look ahead to 2014. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Mike Sielski is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. In fact, came to the Inquirer from the Wall Street Journal. He's also the author of two books, Fading Echoes and How to Be Like Jackie Robinson, which he co-wrote with Pat Williams. And Mike Sielski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Sam Donnellan is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, a job he's had since 1992. His work has been recognized by the Associated Press Sports Editors, the National Sports Writers and Sports Casters Association, and the Associated Press Managing Editors of Pennsylvania, among others. And Sam Donnellan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
Sam, let me quote something that you wrote on February 14th, 2013 about Chip Kelly. I believe Kelly will be a great NFL coach. I like how he thinks even more than what he thinks.
Yeah, I'm not usually that right, but boy, has that shown up this fall. I mean, the idea that he was a one-trick pony has been really put to rest that he is not. He's been able to adjust. He's been able to rethink things. And what I love the best about him is he's been able to say, I've been right eight times and wrong. Well, now he's right nine times and wrong six times, you know. So,
how do you see him, Mike?
I like him a lot. I think he's a guy who, he's very smart, and you can see how smart he is and how he interacts with even us in the media. He's been somebody, so far anyway, who speaks very openly, it seems, as honestly as an NFL coach will speak to the media in his press conferences. And it seems like what you see is what you get with him. There's been some interesting video, I don't know if Sam, if you've seen this, that's come out of him interacting with players during games, mm-hmm. and he's as frank. It seems he's as frank with them during games as he is with us in his press conferences, and that's neat to see.
Well, and he has this hurry-up offense.
Yeah,
is that a key to his success or the team's success?
I think early on it was more. It stood out more than it has recently. I mean, now it is more of a no huddles, and the purpose for no huddle is that the defense cannot substitute. If you don't substitute, they can't substitute. But I would not say that I'm sitting there on most Sundays and going, I can't write this down, it's going too fast, which I was early on. Right. It was like covering an NBA game.
Right, and I think the other dimension that's started to emerge and that people have started to take a deeper look at is exactly, it's not just that he's calling and having his plays run quickly, it's what's actually happening in those plays. If you watch that Sunday night game, you know, earlier this week where the Eagles just destroyed the Bears, there were some pass patterns and formations that in their design were unbelievably almost insightful, I would say, mm-hmm. and complex and how they're carried out. And you watch them and you go, I haven't seen that before, but why haven't I seen that before? Because that works and it should work. And you see them, the players executing it perfectly, and you say, oh, okay, that tells you what this guy is made of.
But is he making this up as he goes along? Is he calling plays like that?
Well, I think, yes and no, I guess. He has, off of most plays, he has four or five options, which I don't think is that radically different from other coaches, but it's that when he sets it up, the defense looks at it, and it looks like this thing, but it really could be this other thing. But even inside of that is this third thing. You know, a lot has been made about read option. There has not been as much read option, obviously, with Nick Foles because nobody's afraid of him, you know, holding onto the ball and running down the field. I do think, to Mike's point, you can also see it when it doesn't work. In the first Dallas game, right, when he doesn't get going on first down, this thing comes to a grinding halt. They kick it to the other team in bad field position, and that defense gets really exposed. I mean, for all we talked about the Minnesota loss, Minnesota teed it up on the 40 or the 50-yard line almost every single time they had the ball. That's not a recipe for success.
No, it's not.
Let me quote you quoting Chip Kelly, Sam, and he said, a lot of coaches have great ideas, but we're not playing the game. The players are playing the game. It's about putting them in position where they can be successful. Our offense is always going to be tailored to who's playing, which is a segue into the Nick Foles. I mean, how do you understand, I guess, the relationship between these two guys, Mike?
Between Chip and Nick?
Yes.
I think...
I got that.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting one. I think the common perception now is that Nick is kind of the vessel through whom the offense flows. That there was this perception that Chip, in coming here and having coached such a prolific offense at the University of Oregon, where his quarterbacks were always mobile and could move and run, and as Sam said, run the read option. Well, Nick Foles, I mean, he looks like he's running through frozen molasses. So you're not going to run that kind of offense. But what he can do is make quick, intelligent decisions. He can throw the football accurately to his receivers. And so Chip has looked at that and said, okay, if that's the case, I can run him a little bit just to kind of keep the defense honest, to let people think this is still what I want to do. And yet he's smart enough, Nick is smart enough to, you know, get the ball to this guy on this play and that guy on that play and just kind of let everything flow through him. And as a football coach, I think that's kind of what you want.
What do you see, Sam?
Yeah, well, he went through, I just stick on this example because it's such a perfect example. He went through a season at UNH once when he was the offensive coordinator, in which he started in spring with five quarterbacks. One transferred out, one blew out his knee. So now it's the start of football season, he's got three. One gets hurt, one's ineffective. Anyway, it was like the fourth or fifth guy is this guy, Ricky Santos, who Chip was really mad at because of his work ethic. He had improved his work ethic. He was as stationary as a tree. And Chip had set the whole offense up for this other guy who's from South Jersey who could run like the wind. So not only does Ricky Santos succeed in his offense, he wins the Walter Payton Award, which is the equivalent at that level of the Heisman Trophy Award. Now, anybody who says, oh, the guy's going to get killed in the NFL, he doesn't know how to adjust. He may get killed in the NFL because his stuff doesn't work or it's based on faulty premises, but the guy knows how to adjust. And that was that they told me that at UNH when I went up there way back in January, is don't think of him as a one-trick pony. We had a lot of different personnel types at UNH. Obviously, you can't pick and choose. It's not like being Alabama or Oregon. You have to get whatever gets to you. That's what you have to work with.
It's an interesting dynamic, I think, in this sports city in particular, for a couple reasons. Number one, we're coming off of 14 years, and we were discussing this before the show began. We're coming off 14 years of Andy Reid as the Eagles head coach.
And it was that long.
Yeah, it was that long. That's a lot of press conferences.
I thought it was longer, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And for all of Andy's strengths as a head coach, probably his greatest weakness was that he did not adjust within the game. You know, that when it got to Sunday, he had his plan, and he was going to stick to it. And to see Kelly be able to change midstream in the middle of a game, it's a snowstorm against the Detroit Lions, and I may want to throw the ball against this defense, but you know what? I have the best running back in football, and nobody else can stay on their feet, so I'm just going to give it to LeSean McCoy, and he's going to run straight ahead, and that's what's going to happen, because that's what needs to happen in this particular game. That's one thing. The other thing is that Philadelphia, I think, just from a sports culture standpoint, isn't accustomed to having someone who is innovative, or is perceived as innovative throughout the national scene of sports. And that's who Chip Kelly is right now. People are looking at him and trying to figure him out. And that's an interesting kind of change of pace. We're used to our own here, if that makes any sense. And so I'm curious to see how this all kind of plays out, based on the game Sunday against the Cowboys and perhaps moving forward.
Well, it makes you wonder how many Eagles fans are thinking, oh, this is it, and this is as far as we're going to get. It's not going to work out. He's going to run through all his magic tricks.
And I keep saying to people, wait a second, you're the ones who said it was a rebuilding year, and I hope we get a quarterback in the spring. Now you've played yourself right out of getting a good draft pick, and you're still not saying it's a successful season. I mean, they could go down to Dallas and lay an egg. They've laid a few eggs this year. And to Mike's point, he's also made, in my view, made mistakes with the following week with Shady only carrying the ball eight times. I think he was chasing the lead in that game too quickly. I think he probably says that to himself right now. But the other thing is, he is willing to say a lot to us about the mistakes he's made and to teach us. I mean, I think we all – if we're honest, we all would admit that we have learned more football in this 1 year through
right.
him than we did in the 14 years of Andy. Because we will say, why did you – somebody was talking about the Wildcat when he brought this player in. And he said that's not the Wildcat. And then he laid out an explanation on why it's not the Wildcat. But everyone that Sunday thought he was using
right.
the Wildcat.
But he set you straight.
In his mind, he set it straight. I mean, it's short visually, it still looks like the Wildcat. The next time somebody sets up a play with that, we're all going to say Wildcat again. But he had a complete explanation for why it wasn't Wildcat. And that's real kind, for me, kind of fun because I didn't play the sport and I've been following it for so long. To have them instruct me on what I am and am not watching, I felt very refreshing.
And Mike, what's his relationship with the other players? Him meaning the coaches, his relationship with the other players on the team?
Well, I think he came here as an offensive guru, so to speak. So he lets Billy Davis, his defensive coordinator, kind of handle the defense. That's his domain. But, you know, he hasn't had a chance. The interesting part that we haven't brought up yet is there was this presumption when Chip got here that, okay, he's going to need time to remake the team in the way he wants it. We need to get Chip – the Eagles are going to need to get Chip Kelly players in here. And they still very well might. But he's taken largely what was already here. It wasn't as if the Eagles completely reshaped the roster in the offseason from the time they fired Andy Reid and hired Chip Kelly. These are still predominantly Andy Reid's players. And he's taken them and, as we mentioned before, worked with them to turn them into this offensive juggernaut that has a chance to go to the playoffs. Players love him. I think players appreciate his honesty. I think players like the fresh approach that he brings, blasting music at practice, you know, the sports science end of things, the fact that he pays attention to, okay, here's what we're going to eat on this day, and this is going to keep
things
you healthier.
Like nutrition,
right? This is going to keep you healthier and playing well over the longer term. And he seems to keep things pretty loose. He slaps a lot of backs. He pumps a lot of hands during practice. Mm-hmm. And I think guys like that compared to some of the stuffier coaches around the league.
Although I would say Andy, to us, was stuffy to his players.
Right.
He got much of the same loyalty. And there was video that would catch Andy of congratulating guys. Now, we tend to judge Andy by the last image where he was just struggling with you know, everything gone wrong. He had gone through coordinators like you know, bubblegum, and he didn't have the team he wanted. The people were getting injured. So
and
that
his
is
family
our,
life was fine.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you know, if you look at Andy in those first couple of years, I think we all got wowed by his organizational skills, having come from Ray Rhodes. And so I think we do have to watch it a little bit with the romance on Chip in terms of players loving him. They love him because it succeeds.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they'd love him if they were 2-11 right now or whatever.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking sports in this hour of Radio Times, beginning with the Eagles for all the obvious reasons. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We will also be talking about the Sixers and the Flyers and the Phillies, looking back on the year 2013 when it comes to Philadelphia sports, and of course looking to 2014 as well. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you 2 tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, neuroscientist Sam Harris on the high cost of lies, even tiny ones.
It's the antithesis of integrity and openness and authenticity. And when you're pretending to be someone you're not, you're paying a price even if it's not obvious to you.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In this hour of the show, the year in Philadelphia sports, our guests are Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Sam Donnellan, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mike, if I can go back to you, but Sam, I'd like to hear from you as well. We were chatting about this during the break, about the problem of contact sports like football and concussions. We know of these veteran players who now have, you know, serious brain injury as a result of what appears to be all the contact and all the concussions that they received while playing football. Does it make it difficult for you, obviously an enthusiast, to know that people could be hurting themselves on the field?
Sure, it absolutely does. I have a 2.5-year-old son, and it's a conversation that, I mean, it's come up between my wife and me, but not one we've gone into in depth, but if he wanted to play, would we let him play?
Right.
I'm conflicted about it from this standpoint, because I'm still a believer in free will, and I wonder how much of, while you see this new research and you see the obvious effects of playing the sport on these older players and even younger players to a great extent, at some level they're still making a choice to play. And there is a, I don't even know what the phrase would be. You hear warrior ethos and all those sorts, and that takes us into a realm I don't even want to, you know, that would be a whole other show. But there's conflicts on many different levels with respect to this. And yes, when you're sitting there watching the game and you see a big hit where you see a player take a knee to the back of the head, I think Sam would agree that always goes through the back of your mind is, did he suffer a concussion on that play? If so, how long is he going to be out? If he's out, what are the long-term ramifications? All those sorts of things go through your mind.
Yeah, I mean, just to switch sports real quick, Braden Shen looked like Joe Frazier against George Foreman the other day when he was hit into the boards and he tried to get up like three different times and fell down. The amazing thing is Braden Shen played that very next game, like 2 or 3 days later, and they did all those tests and such. And this is what the great mystery to me is I think anytime you can't get up, you're concussed. But I don't know, you know, where that level is that they say things. I will say this, that my pet theory is the equipment. I mean, two guys go up in soccer all the time to head a ball. There can be no greater concussion risk, but they've been playing forever and ever, and there is a certain mutual respect there, so you don't see that as often as you would see a head-to-head hit in football, where there's the false belief that that helmet is not only protecting you, but helping you bring another person down. I think the same thing has happened in hockey over the years, is the helmets and the cages and stuff that were developed to protect people have become weaponry. I tell the story, Mark Recchi had elbow pads for practice that were soft and spongy, and then the ones for the games, which were like everybody else's, had the plastic armor on each elbow, so when you threw the check, you were dishing it out as much as defending, you know.
We have a Facebook comment from Stephen. Why is it there's so little media coverage of Philadelphia's second-tier teams? And I guess we're talking about, what, second soccer?
The soccer team.
I think because the passion is so fervent for the four major teams that it kind of, to a great extent, drowns everything else out. I mean, you see this to a certain extent even with college basketball. I mean, Philadelphia is regarded as a great college basketball city because of the Big Five. But if you look at, you know, email, if you write a column about Villanova or Temple, or you watch LaSalle's run to the Sweet 16 last year, and I'm not just bringing that up because I'm a LaSalle alumnus.
Yes, you are.
But that doesn't generate the reader interest, the traffic on Philly.com that, you know, if I typed Nick Foles 75 times and posted that as a column, that would get more hits and reader response than writing a beautiful 1,000-word piece on Fran Dunphy, the Temple basketball coach.
Jay Wright once said that during the height of the Big East, he said, you know, the best thing about this job is if I lose on Sunday, we're not talking about it on Thursday. Whereas the guy down at Duke is, the guy down at Carolina is, the guy at Syracuse is, you know, he gets the best of both worlds. It's also, I guess, from an attention standpoint, the worst of both worlds. But I would say that usually it's the Union fans that are asking that question. And I would say, you know, you've got a great fan base there. Now make it bigger. You know, that we're reactionary.
And I'll add one thing. I will say this, though. 2 weeks ago, or however long ago it was, when Temple trimmed those seven sports.
Indeed. Big story.
It was a big story, and there was a lot of coverage of it, and there was a lot of reader and fan and citizen interest in that. So when the story is big enough, there will be that interest and there will be that coverage.
Stephen, thanks for that comment on Facebook. Let me see what Frank from Center City, Philadelphia has to say, and then we'll talk about the 76ers. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks, Marty.
You're
thanks
welcome.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I want to get the two commenters' opinion about where the evolution of football will go in the era of target tackling. What do I mean by that? I mean, you can't hit them high, you can't hit them low, you have to avoid concussions and ACLs, and how is that going to evolve the sport in terms of ongoing attractiveness and, you know,
interesting.
All that.
No, Frank, thanks for the call. And Sam,
my little theory, Frank, is that then they adjust the rules in other places. You saw it this year, I think, in defensive back coverage, and if the Eagles are lucky, you'll see it on Sunday. In the sense that in the beginning of the season, they enforced the rule book. If you touched a guy, it seemed, going down the field, it was an interference call. The last, I would say, what, eight games or so, guys are wrestling with each other on the way down the field. So that the ultimate concern is you don't want 49, 47 games every week. You were getting those early in the season with lots of teams. Lots of teams are putting those kind of points up. Now you're getting one or two of those games. I think what you're going to see is they'll adjust the rules somewhere else to try to keep the game rational.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, this gets this phrase, or however you want to frame it, gets used a lot, but I do think the actual act of tackling is going to have to change. If you watch clips of games in the 60s and 70s, if you watch Dick Butkus wrestle a running back to the ground, that's literally what he did. He grabbed him around the chest and threw him or took him down to the ground. This gets back to what Sam earlier said about equipment, is that it's very easy for these guys, given how big they are, how fast they are, to turn themselves into human missiles, to just launch themselves at a player, be it at his head, be it at his knee. And that ends up on a highlight on SportsCenter, but it isn't necessarily the way, the safest way and the most fundamentally sound way for anybody to administer a tackle in football. So, again, there are a lot of working parts there.
Right.
I personally would like to see the equipment be worse in a way. I think that would help.
Take
I honestly do.
They pull back a little bit on there.
Yeah. I mean, so that way a person who's actually tackling an opposing player
feels it
himself.
Right. If you see Australian rules football, which some of, we're starting to get punters and kickers from that league, they are playing football or a version of rugby football without the equipment or with much of the equipment gone. Same thing with rugby. I think that there's something to be said about the losing the bravado of the equipment protecting you.
Frank, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. So, Sam, do you have any predictions or sense about what's going to happen on Sunday?
Wow,
I don't.
The Eagles' position is that was a blip on the schedule, but the defensive coordinator for the Cowboys, probably anybody in the league, has seen Chip Kelly more times over in the Pac-12 over the years. Monty Kiplin, he's an old seen-it-all, been-there guy. That said, Dallas's defense looks just horrible against everybody but the Eagles in that game. So I can't imagine that they're not telling the truth and saying they just had a really bad day. And I can't believe, particularly if it's we haven't even talked about Tony Romo with his herniated disc. If it's either Romo with a bad back,
we don't know yet.
I'm rooting for him to play. I mean, I have a herniated disc. I'm rooting for him to play
because you know he'll be in pain.
Well, right, he's not going to be that effective, and they're going to come after him. I mean, I'd rather have that than a guy chomping at on the at the bit, you know, who hasn't played all year, is completely healthy and has been practicing with that offense. So, but that said, it should be an Eagles victory. The Eagles have been up and down all season, but it should be an Eagles
victory. What do you think, Mike?
I would be very surprised if this were not an easy Eagles victory. I know it's the culture of sports in this town. We all kind of walk around looking to the sky for the anvil that's about to fall on our heads. Mm-hmm. I get that. But
you wrote that.
Yeah.
You wrote a really good column.
But by the same token, this is the guy in Chip Kelly that everybody around the league is trying to catch up to. And this team doesn't seem to have that kind of burden of the past with them. You know, when Andy and Donovan McNabb were here, that was all you talked about was they couldn't get it done. It's another big game. Are they going to be able to come up big? Chip Kelly and this team seem to look at that and go, okay, we had our blip against the Minnesota Vikings. We played lousy. We're past that now. This is a game they should win. I think it is a game they will win pretty easily. And the one thing we haven't mentioned yet is the Cowboys' best defensive player, Sean Lee
right,
is not playing. He's their middle linebacker. He's the captain in the heart of that defense. He's not going to play.
And they're a sports soap opera almost every week. Almost every week, SportsCenter is starting off with something that happened on their sidelines or something about their coach's status. And meanwhile, you have a team peaking at least in terms of unity. You know, you have a team, a one-for-all, all-for-one kind of team. It sets up, to, as Mike says, to be a lopsided win, which makes people in Philadelphia way more nervous than the other way around.
Exactly. I just felt my blood pressure go up there. And that's Sam Donnellan, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News. Also with us is Mike Silski, and he's sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And yes, we are talking about Philadelphia's sports teams, including the Eagles, the 76ers, the Flyers, and of course the Phillies. And taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Well, let's talk a little bit about the 76ers. They also have this new coach, Brett Brown. They started, 3-0, and then it's kind of looked downhill from there, Mike.
Which is exactly what they want.
Help me understand. They were scaring us there for a while.
Basically,
by actually winning?
Yeah, they were early starting.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the NBA, about basketball in particular, is that one player can make such a huge difference in a team's fortunes, because there's only 5 on the floor and 12 on your roster, that the Sixers have looked at this with their new coach, Brett Brown, and particularly with their new general manager, Sam Hinkie, and recognized we have to find a way to get those great players. And for the decade previously, they had kind of existed in this purgatory where they weren't quite bad enough to get a high pick in the draft, to get one of those great players, but they weren't quite good enough to really have a chance to win a championship. So they said, we're going to create a young team. We're going to struggle and deal with it this year and go try our best with a young and inexperienced and not particularly talented group, and the losses will kind of take care of themselves, and we'll come back and hopefully get a high pick in the draft and free some salary cap space, and if everybody can just be patient, we'll start building a winning team.
Be patient in Philadelphia with a sports team,
well,
Sam?
Well, this was exactly the formula for the Eagles. This was supposed to be, I mean, every word, I was listening to his words, I'm going, yep, that's exactly what we said about Chip Kelly. And they got, I think they got the right guy there, too, in terms of Brett Brown as a teacher. You know, speaking of, by the way, that guy Zamarchi that I said at the beginning of the show played on an undefeated state championship basketball game with Brett Brown back. Those are the degrees of separation we're talking about between Chip Kelly and all these moving parts. So, but I think they've got the right guy in there. I think that's probably why it took so long, is that Brett had to be convinced that this was going to be something that he could work with within a couple of years, which I guess he does. But that's the pattern that we're seeing with the Sixers is what we thought we were going to see with the Eagles.
Right. But the idea is that it's not going to.
You're not tanking.
We're not going to try to be
talent.
A losing team.
Right.
But
I think what you're doing also too is trying to sell players, and not sell them, like that's a bad. But you're trying to make players desirable by other teams to be put into positions so you can move some. I mean, I don't expect the current Sixers to be around as a unit too much longer. I mean, they're trying to make, I don't know if they're making Evan Turner a piece for themselves, but they're certainly trying to make him look like a piece for somebody.
Right. I mean, you have a certain set number of players, Michael Carter Williams at the top of the list, who you're trying to develop and keep here. It seems the rest of them are just kind of movable parts so that, okay, what can we get back for an Evan Turner or a Thaddeus Young? And in the meanwhile, okay, we'll play hard and Brett Brown will teach defensive fundamentals and the Miami Heat will beat us by 20 points. and eventually we'll get to the point where we have a really high draft pick, and let's see how things go from there.
But were they truly nervous that 3-0 start? I mean, were they thinking?
That was an effort. I mean, you see that in the NBA at times throughout the season, but early on, that was they had effort, and the other teams who already knew who they were. We're getting in shape, if you will.
It's funny. I went to a I covered an early season game after they got off to that 3-0 start, and Carter Williams was the rage of the NBA. He had these three great games out of the chute, and I sat next to Sam Hinkie, the GM, watching shoot around, and I said, "So, your point guard looks pretty good, doesn't he?" And he paused and he said, "It's a long season," and
which it is,
and that but that gives you an insight into the perspective that he is bringing to this is that. It's one thing to just try to win every single year, and that sounds great, and we love that here, that effort. But by the same token, there's a certain way you have to go about doing it, particularly in the NBA, and he's going to stick to that formula.
And, he's the rookie manager, right?
He's the first-year GM.
MCW, Michael Carter Williams. I would say to fans out there, if you can get a picture of yourself with him autographed, it is going to be so valuable 20 years from now because that body – they'll go, "Oh my God, look at how tiny that guy's
body." He looks like a praying mantis. He really does.
He's an 19-year-old 6'6 point guard. I can't imagine what he eats and how much he eats, but any fuel that's going in there, it's just...
He's just burning it right away.
Being burned right off.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Flyers. They, too, have a new coach, this Craig Berube. And he was a longtime player. I was actually reading about him, Sam. He spent 3,000 minutes in a penalty box in his career.
Yeah.
That's 50 hours.
And that's so hard. That is so hard for fans that don't follow hockey to understand. If you ever talk to Chief all the way through his career.
And that's his nickname.
Right. His own, he's embraced it. I mean, he's part of Canadian Indian. I don't know what Native Canadian. I don't know what the proper phrase of it is. But that's been his own nickname. There was some controversy about that earlier in the season. He was always an intelligent guy. Always, you know, one of the things you will find about the enforcers in hockey is they read books. They're enforcers because that's their avenue in, and that's how they're getting to make more money than they would make elsewhere. But they tend to be pretty smart guys who are usually some of the best conversations you're going to have going into the room. They figured it all out of what I need to do to play in this league. That said, I wouldn't just call Berube a straight up goon. I think he could play a little bit. He could put the puck in the net if it showed up on his stick around the scoring area. So and I'm sure being a fourth line or fifth line guy, he was watching the game the way a bench player watches basketball and then becomes a great coach.
And is goon another word for enforcer, Mike?
Yeah, but with the caveat that Sam mentioned, there's a difference, I would say, between a goon whose pure purpose is to go out there and throw his fists and he really doesn't have any skill at all, and an enforcer who can do a little bit of both, who could go out there and reaffirm that culture in hockey that you don't take a cheap shot at our star player because if you do, I will come out there and I will challenge you or the other tough guy on your team to a fight and there will be... You know, there'll be a punishment for that. Right. Let's put it that way.
Some of the biggest, by the way, just historically, some of the biggest goons have gone on to become very good general managers and coaches.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he's not unprecedented. If he ends up being a good coach, it's not unprecedented. A guy named John Ferguson was the GM up in Montreal for years and years. And if you watch old video of John Ferguson, those were the slap shot days of the NHL.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about Philadelphia sports in this hour of the show with Sam Donnellan, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News, and Mike Sielski, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. We want to hear from you. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. Any sports questions or comments, go to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet me @MartyMossCoane. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of service in the tri-state area, SCORE, Counselors to America's Small Business, supports WHYY. A partner of the U.S. Small Business Administration, SCORE is a nonprofit agency dedicated to helping entrepreneurs start a business and existing businesses to grow. For information on counseling and seminars, or to volunteer counseling services, online at scorebuckscounty.org or 215-943-8850.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our holiday week series with Mel Brooks.
Public radio, I mean, nobody's even paying for this. This is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
Also, we hear from a comic Mel Brooks thinks is very funny, Amy Schumer. She writes, directs, and stars in Inside Amy Schumer on Comedy Central. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Being responsible to a moment and to a year that changed everything for a young filmmaker.
When something happens to somebody in their immediate circle, to somebody who looks like them, somebody who they can relate to, it's devastating, you know? I mean, it's something that marked our whole community.
Director Ryan Coogler on the making of Fruitvale Station. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, having a lot of fun talking with Sam Donnellan and Mike Sielski about Philadelphia and its sports teams. We're talking Eagles, we're talking Sixers, Flyers, and yes, we will be talking about the Phillies as well, looking back over the year 2013 and obviously looking forward to 2014. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Just picking up on, we've been talking about the Flyers. Not doing so well, though, Mike, are they? They certainly didn't start out.
No, I think they're a mediocre team with a mediocre level of talent on their team. The NHL nowadays, a lot of the success of a particular team is predicated on one position right now, I think, which is defensemen. And you need to have fast, intelligent defensemen because they get the puck out of your zone, they cycle it up to your forwards and get the, you know, they keep the puck out of harm's way, basically. And the Flyers, if they have a major weakness, and they have a few, I would say that's their number one thing, is that their defensemen are a little older, a little slower. They've played better lately. The system that Berube has installed has got the entire team more defensive-minded, so they're playing a little bit better than they had been. But I think it's, even if they make the playoffs, I think it's going to be it's asking a lot of them to make a deep run.
You think they might make the playoffs?
I think it's possible, as the last seed.
They played themselves back into it. I mean,
yeah.
they were awful. You know,
you're 1-7 start.
Right. And your lead-in would probably, a Flyer fan would get outraged at that because I think they feel their team is on a roll right now, a little hot. I mean, what I see is it's a little bit more optimistic than Mike because of lately who they're beating. The Minnesota Wild, who handled them very easily out in Minnesota less than a month ago, that was a significant win to me. Beating good teams are significant wins to me, rather than, I think, when they built themselves back up, they were playing within their very, very mediocre division and beating those teams. They're starting to get what I would call signature wins, and starting to develop, to Mike's point, a style that was almost contradictory to the previous coach's style. And that's why I'm giving them a little bit more leeway. I've seen this before, where a team with a good goalie figures things out in the first half of the season. I used to joke that as long as you don't play yourself out of it, the NHL season begins after the ball game.
Oh, right. Wow.
And I think they're in a position now where they're in that NHL season.
Yeah. The question for me is the Flyers' tradition, and I think this is true of this team too, and Sam, disagree with me if you think I'm wrong here.
Just jump all over him.
Yeah.
If he's wrong,
we'll turn this into a real sports style gradient.
You're about to bring in the culture thing.
No. What I was going to say is that the Flyers play hard every single night.
Yes.
Effort is not an issue with this team. It never is. That's great during the regular season in the middle of December, in January. But once the stretch drive hits and the teams that can kind of, not lollygag, but can kind of coast through the regular season because they have superior talent, really start to turn it on, that's where I think this team might run into problems.
Mm-hmm. Where I might disagree with it is that I've seen teams like them beat the Flyers, the more talented Flyers, over and over again. The Sabres in the years with Lindy Rupp, where they really didn't have the talent before the cap, even, where they were paying The amount of money the Sabres were making, the amount of money the Flyers were making, were almost like 2-1. Mm-hmm. The Devils, I think, for years have gotten away with a couple of good offensive players. Now, they had Scott Stevens, a really good defenseman, for a while, anchoring things there. But really with a lot of names that you hadn't heard of until they showed up with Marty Brodeur standing behind them. To Mike's point of a few minutes ago, I would say I agree with the defense first, but I agree goalie first. And that's been more than a culture thing. That's been the Flyers' absolute Achilles heel. They just cannot seem to get the goalie thing figured out since Bernie Perron or Pelle Lindbergh.
Way back. Is it unusual for a sports town like Philadelphia to have four, major head
New
coaches?
Yorker teams?
No. Head coaches for all the major professional teams.
New ones?
Yeah, in 1 year. Is that weird?
I think so. I mean, it's
probably happens in Houston.
Yeah. I think,
I don't know.
I think what's unusual about it from Philadelphia's perspective is that you had guys who had been in those roles, and certainly in Charlie Manuel and Andy Reid, far longer than is usual. Even Peter Laviolette was above average, and he was only the Flyers head coach for, 3.5 years, I think.
Right.
They were all well above average in terms of, if you look at their respective leagues, how long does a head coach stay in place. So it's unusual for Philadelphia to have this situation now in light of the fact that Charlie was with the Phillies for 9.5 years, and Andy was with the Eagles for 14.
And the NHL example is a good one because they churn through those guys like crazy. There really are only one or two or three examples of coaches that last more than a few years. Just because, to go to your point about effort, hockey is by definition such an effort sport that the guys are some of the best guys you get to talk to, and some of the worst quotes you'll ever get. Not because they're trying to be bad quotes, just because the premise of the game is to outwork the other guy.
Oh.
So there are only so many ways you can describe that. And so you
are you
get,
talking as a writer here?
Yes. Oh, sure. We joke about, winning the other guy's barn, win the 50-50 battle.
Mucking and grinding
and all that. We got to outwork them for 60 minutes, got to play 60 minutes.
Yep.
I mean, we joke, we walk into the rink sometimes, uttering those to each other.
In a pinch, I just write my own quotes.
Because it's got to be that anyway. Right?
Exactly.
Well, we're learning all sorts of things. We have a tweet from Rusty. Can we talk about how much longer Ruben Amaro Jr. has left with the Phillies and what's his legacy?
That is the number one, right?
Yeah.
That's a good segue to the Phillies.
If there's public enemy number one in Philadelphia sports right now, I think it's Ruben.
Yeah.
And that's, Ruben got rid of Charlie, and that's his own fault. Now the bullets used to hit each of them equally. Now it's just Ruben. I mean, the angst towards Ruben, and it's really funny because he was so celebrated when he brought Cliff Lee back. Not so celebrated when he jettisoned him prematurely and probably cost them at least a World Series. But it doesn't seem that the people who replaced Mike Arbuckle are bringing players through the system of the caliber of Chase Utley and Jimmy Rollins and Cole Hamels and Ryan Howard. So there's nothing behind it, and now he's chasing. He's got the money. For years we complained about this team being cheap.
Right.
They're not cheap anymore, but they don't even have a base for which to go and add big pieces.
Right, and what happens in a situation like that is that you never end up developing what could have been called a Phillies culture, because you're not bringing these guys up through your system.
Mm.
You're basically going out and signing mercenaries who come in, for a year or two, and they're used to their own way. Mercenaries is a strong term, but it just means a veteran ball player. I just mean a veteran ball player who has been in the league 8-9 years, and he's used to doing things his way, and he's going to do things his way no matter he plays for the Phillies or the Yankees or whoever. Whereas if you see organizations that have sustained success over time, the Braves, for example, or teams like that, they're constantly bringing guys up, the Cardinals, through their minor league system, and getting kind of inculcated into the way things are done within our particular organization. The other thing I'd say with respect to Ruben Amaro is it's instructive. Ed Wade, who was public enemy number one here before he was fired, in 2000, five. Was here 7 years as a general manager with a few last place finishes in there. So Ruben became the GM in 2009. And David Montgomery, the Phillies president and the guy who makes in the ownership group who makes the baseball decisions, is very loyal. So Ruben's been here since 2009. You're looking at 2016 if he matches Ed Wade's tenure.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. We have another tweet. This is from Guy. Isn't it overdue for the Phillies to start rebuilding?
Yeah, I think, they have a few few balls that, in the air that prevent them from doing that. I think they want finality to the Ryan Howard situation. They want to find out if he's going to be David Ortiz or a slugger that just falls off the map into
hurt,
his 30s.
Right?
Well, David Ortiz was that a couple of years for the Red Sox. I think he signed to, they signed him to like a discount deal. Everybody, I included, thought he was washed up. He couldn't stay on the field, et cetera, et cetera. The last 2 years he's been on the field, and obviously anybody who watched the World Series,
he's still pretty great
at whatever age, 38 or something. That would be the ideal, would be that Ryan Howard comes back and is that guy for the next 3 or 4 years, and we're having a conversation about whether to re-up him or not. But I think the general consensus, given the last couple of years, is that Ryan Howard's shot. I think we're all nervous about Chase Utley, even though he put in a full season with those knees.
He's 35.
Right. Jimmy Rollins looks like he's fallen off the cliff in terms of offense. But I think they're in a position where they've got – nobody wants these guys anyway, so they kind of have to ride them and hope – the 2009 Yankees that beat them had a bunch of old guys that were supposed to be too old. They weren't good. They're rooting for that scenario to happen for themselves. They still have – you know, front end pretty good starting pitchers and the two left-handers. So I think they feel like they have enough pieces that if they get really lucky.
Right.
Used to be
if we get a little lucky. Now it's if we get really lucky.
Right. And the other factor, too, is that from a sentimental standpoint, I mean, this was a franchise that had won one world championship in, 125 years, however long it had been. And you get this core of players in Utley, Rollins, Howard, Hamels, and you get this era unlike really any other in the franchise's history, except maybe the late 70s into the early 80s. And I think there is a feeling that we don't want to let that go. This is as good as we've ever had it, and it's because of these guys. And so we're going to try to wring every last drop of success we can out of this core before we say to ourselves, it's over.
That point is you think the stars that left, they were all guys that they developed into stars, but they were from outside organizations. Shane Victorino, Jason Worth, Hunter Pence. They were willing to let those guys go, but not the guys that they built themselves.
Mm. Let me get to it. Looks like Ann from Ardmore to join our conversation. Ann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I've got to say, I'm 71. I had my fill of football by the time I was 17 because my dad played in high school, and we always had 3 games going, 2 TV sets and a radio all weekend long.
Lucky you.
And by extension, most sports, you know, unless one of the Philadelphia teams is up for a pennant, I don't get involved. But I've been really interested this morning to find myself really engaged in listening to this conversation.
Thank you.
And
thanks.
I appreciate it immensely. And I hope someday somebody will come up with a friendly guide for the older woman.
We're always trying to write books, ma'am.
We just did,
so.
Anne, for you.
This you is just gave me an idea for a book.
It'll be called 50 Shades of Harry Potter for senior citizen sports fans.
Well, I really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate your call.
It's a genetic thing in your program, as Marty.
Well, thanks so much. No, I appreciate it. And just to give a shout out to our two guests, it's, you know, I do believe, at least on the radio, you can talk to you can talk about anything if you have two really good guests, and we
absolutely
have that, so that certainly helps. And I appreciate
absolutely
the call to Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to pick up on something we were saying during the break about hair. Because I'm one of those, you know, what are the front runners? Is that what we're called? The people that get excited?
I'm you know, with you, casual fan. I've got a household full of casual fans.
Okay.
I'm okay.
But
with
I'm noticing
fans.
Many more football players with hair, you know, halfway down their back.
Sure.
And I'm not complaining. But it's just an interesting.
Well, they had
phenomenon
to put a rule in, right? You can't tackle by the hair.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
That's
a
relatively
new
rule.
Is it just a kind of a thing, a trend?
I think it's probably a trend writ large in the culture, and you're just seeing it on the football field as well. I mean, you see it in baseball, too. Look at Andrew McCutchen, the National League MVP for the Pittsburgh Pirates, has pretty long hair that hangs below his batting helmet.
Look at all old photos of the now bald Jimmy Rollins.
Right, right. You know. Is it more prevalent now? I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to look around and count up long-haired guys on NFL rosters.
But I think there's a marketing. I mean, the guy from Green Bay, Clay Matthews, you know, he looks like some superhero kind of guy with that hair.
Looks
in the
like
body.
Thor. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So he's easy to market. Right. You know, he's a very recognizable look. You know?
So.
Are we talking super? Is it too soon to talk about a possibility of at least making it to the Super Bowl with the Eagles?
Well, you know, a few years ago when they announced that it was going to be in the Meadowlands, I was absolutely convinced that that would be the one that the Eagles would go to the Super Bowl in, just to deny us a really warm weather situation.
Sports writers think of themselves first.
I get that.
At all times.
I totally get that.
Right. They'd be familiar with the stadium anyway. I can't imagine it, although Seattle has shown a little bit of a dent lately. I just feel like there's two or three teams that would have to have a really bad day for them to beat them. That said, I think they could beat almost anybody else other than, I would say, Seattle and San Fran, but other people might say.
I feel about the Eagles this year the way I felt about Seattle last year, which was exactly the same kind of thing. Here's Russell Wilson. He's this rookie quarterback. Here's this terrific defense. Here's this dynamic that nobody's quite gotten a handle on, and even the Seahawks themselves hadn't quite gotten a handle on how good we can really be. And so they go in the first playoff game, and they beat the Washington Redskins. And the second playoff game, they play the Atlanta Falcons in Atlanta. They make this great comeback and end up losing in the final seconds. But I feel that kind of that way about the Eagles, too. They're the team nobody really wants to play. Mm-hmm. You don't quite know what you're getting with them, but they probably aren't quite good enough yet to just to get there, because they're going to have to win basically four straight games, you know, starting this week against the Cowboys. If they do that, they'd host a playoff game. Then they'd have to go on the road, you know, for the next one, and then probably for the one after that. So it would be a hard road.
And the NFC is filled with teams that are pretty good when they're playing on the road, but really good at home. Seattle is, other than a game they didn't really have to have, Seattle is almost unbeatable at home.
Right.
San Fran is a much tougher match on home than they are on the road. New Orleans is impossible at home, but very mediocre on the road. So they're not going to get the advantage of bringing them into, even a neutral site would be better, you know.
But the game on Sunday is in
Dallas.
In Dallas.
But that's a good thing. Here's my theory on that. When a team is like Dallas or the Giants, you want to play a team where the fans are mad at them. Because the moment they do something wrong, and we've seen it here, that people are booing in the first quarter, then that's not a home field advantage. And I think that's, you have a chance, if you get off quick on Sunday, of making that crowd work for you, not against you.
Well, on that note, my thanks to the two of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Sam Donnellan, thank you very much. And he's a sports columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News. And Mike Sicilski, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Barney.
And he's sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And yes, from time to time on Radio Times, we do talk sports. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, and Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we want to close things out, something for the Philadelphia Eagles, the Philadelphia Eagles fight song. Let's listen.
Fly, fly, eagles, fly.